This topic, grief, joy, and awakening, is one that's been very close to my heart for many years. It came up actually for a couple of reasons in relation to this particular talk, because almost to the day, this is the 25-year anniversary of the death of a very close friend of mine who I met when I was in fifth grade, when he and his family moved to an area east of Cleveland, Ohio, where I was growing up. His name was Billy. And we became close friends in part because he had a very difficult home life and spent a great deal of time at our house. His parents had a lot of problems and it was a very unhappy household. So he was almost like a surrogate brother, although I already had an older brother, and Billy was a year older than I was. We became fast friends, shared a lot of interests. When we went to college, he went a year ahead of me to Tulane University in New Orleans, and after visiting him down there, I decided to go there as well. And we just stayed connected over the years. We each got married, we had families, and on May 14th of 1997, so not quite to the day, but close, I was sitting with my wife and daughter having dinner. It was a Wednesday night like this, and at that time our group in Boulder that I was teaching met on Wednesday evenings at a yoga studio in Boulder. And the call was from my older brother, who rarely ever called me. Usually it was the other way around, and the fact that he was calling in and of itself was a kind of red flag. Billy had gone on in his own way to become an architect, a very gifted architect, always very healthy. He was a black belt in karate, played a lot of basketball when he was young and in high school, taught himself guitar. Had a lot of gifts, and he had recently completed an addition onto my brother's house on this east side of Cleveland area that we grew up in. And relevant part here, Billy died very suddenly of a heart attack, and my brother was calling to inform me about that. Yeah. It was a real shocker. Never saw that coming. And after I hung up the phone, it was about 6 o'clock, and I was supposed to go to our 7 o'clock group, which met from 7 to 9, lead a sit and give a talk I had prepared. And I certainly wasn't interested in dinner at that point, because I was pretty shocked. And I looked across the table, and I said to Marcia, my wife, how in the world am I going to give a Dharma talk tonight? It seems impossible. And Marcia, Marcia said to me, why don't you talk about Billy? She said, if this isn't what the Dharma is about, what is it about? Right? And I heard what she was saying. And I took it in and I put aside the notes that I had prepared for that talk. And I spoke about Billy and about impermanence and about change, anicca, familiar to many of you probably, and the realities that Buddhist teachings in such a profound way regularly remind us of. Yeah. It was one of the most important talks I think I've given, and ironically, of course, the person on the recording that night I did not know how to use it properly, so it went into the ethers, essentially, right? That was one event, but that's part of what I generally know when this time of the year is coming up, because Billy still comes up in my heart and mind as someone who was very important to me. I'm still in touch with his wife. One of his kids lives out in the Denver area. So I used to see him periodically, although I haven't for a while. That was one event, way back, 25 years, right? The other event that brought this topic up is quite fresh, actually. It took place on Earth Day this year. Some of you might have seen in the news that there was a man in Washington, D.C., who took his own life in front of the Supreme Court building as an environmental protest statement. Yeah. Did it in a pretty painful way, set himself on fire. He was a member of our Sangha, who I'd known for 18 years. 50-year-old man, really wonderful person, very well-loved in the community, on our service committee, so he came every week to the church that we rent when we were meeting before COVID, helped set up the chairs, helped take them down, helped with what needed help. His name was Wynn Bruce. And as you might imagine, none of us in the teaching community saw this coming, although we do have a sister sangha that's focused on activism of various kinds. And that particular sub-community does a lot of environmental actions in Boulder and other places. And Wynn was very involved in that group. So the teacher who leads that group was quite shocked as well by the news. And so it's still, you know, we're about 2.5 weeks out from there, and the shock and the grief and the trauma are very much with me still. And what's interesting to me about all of this is that I think we all know that grief and loss are built in to the experience of being alive as a human being. At least we intellectually understand that. Right? When these kinds of experiences happen, there's a way in which our hearts just break open. And one of the questions that comes up is, when our hearts break open, what will result? Are they then going to contract and tighten up like a rock? Or are they going to become more open and wider in a way that Sharon Salzberg's once described as a heart as wide as the world? Right? When I was living in Nepal, there was an expression I heard that has stayed with me for many years. This goes back to the 80s. It said that, quote, the world is like a grinding stone. It will either grind you up or it will turn you into something beautiful. One of the ways that I understand Dharma teachings is that they're designed to help us be turned into something beautiful by virtue of the difficulties we go through in our lives. This is something Tibetans call turning poison into medicine. Years ago, when Jack Kornfield wrote A Path with Heart, he called it turning straw into gold. Yeah. It's quite central to my understanding of the Buddhist teachings. Yeah. So I think what I'd like to do tonight, I think my intention when I chose this topic was to share some reflections, basically, on the way in which grief, joy, and awakening are essentially one seamless process when we have the eyes to see it and we're willing to open our hearts to what happens. We all know, of course, that Buddhist teachings emphasize quite strongly and directly, quote, seeing reality clearly. That's one of the definitions and translations of the word vipassana, for example, seeing things clearly. Another definition of that word, seeing things as they are. And of course, a third that is the most familiar to most of us is insight. So we often have insight meditation and vipassana meditation being used interchangeably, as a lot of us have heard on many occasions. A lot of people think that Grief is overemphasized in Buddhism if they're not practitioners and they haven't looked deeply at what the teachings are about. On a number of occasions, I've had people ask me things like, why is Buddhism so pessimistic, for example? Right? From my perspective, it's not. I don't think Buddhism and Buddhist teachings are pessimistic. I don't think they're optimistic particularly either. I think they're realistic. They're not advocating seeing the glasses half full in the Pollyanna fashion. They're not advocating seeing the glass as half empty exclusively in terms of over-focusing on what's wrong. To me, they seem to be emphasizing seeing the glass as half empty and half full at the same time. Yeah. And that's realism, which is what seeing things clearly is all about. And in many ways, I think it actualizes a lot of our best human qualities. These teachings come through in the discourses on a regular and consistent basis. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha said it like this: thus shall we think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. Also talked about it in terms of what are called the eight worldly winds in a different sutta. These eight worldly conditions, O monks, keep the world turning around. And the world turns around these eight worldly conditions. What eight? Gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. Now, I can see how that could be misunderstood as grim. Yeah. At the very same time, it's simply true. From my perspective, right? If you look at your life, you can see the interplay of those eight worldly winds on a regular, consistent, and ongoing basis. I don't see that as an interpretation as much as I see it as a description of what's so. And then the question becomes, what's a wise, compassionate, and skillful way to negotiate a human experience that's characterized on a regular basis by those eight conditions? When I first came across Buddhist teachings as a 21-year-old undergraduate student who was wrestling hard with depression and anxiety, among other things, I actually found that teaching to be good news. And why I found it to be good news was because I had a psychological stance in which I saw myself as the problem. The world was the world. I had this belief, like a lot of us do when we come through a family of origin experience with the wounds of unlove that a lot of us have. I had these beliefs about being broken, and something being inadequate or wrong with me, and so forth. And I was interpreting the world through the lens that I was the problem. And then I read a book that Trungpa Rinpoche wrote called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. It came out right about that time and was edited by a couple of local people at Naropa, where I lived in Boulder. And it was very clear in what he said in that book, clearly stated that the world was inherently a difficult place to be at times, which of course is the first noble truth, if it's understood wisely, that life involves suffering. I don't agree with a translation and interpretation that says, quote, all life is suffering, which is sometimes how the teachings are misunderstood and where some of the pessimistic interpretation comes from. I don't agree with that because it doesn't fit my experience. When I look at my life on a moment-to-moment basis, it's not all suffering. Not at all. Yeah. On the other hand, it seems to me that I haven't met anyone yet who has gotten past the age of about 5 minutes who hasn't experienced some kind of suffering. Right? It's just true. And if anyone here hasn't, please, I've got questions for you. Right? So, I remember when Scott Peck, for example, some of you might remember Scott Peck, a psychiatrist years ago who wrote a best-selling book that flew off the shelves called The Road Less Traveled, in which one of the earlier integrations of Western psychology and psychiatry with contemplative and spiritual teachings. First three words in that book were essentially a paraphrase of the First Noble Truth. The book starts out, life is difficult. And if we understand that to be true and we're willing to embrace the First Noble Truth, then we're in a position to look deeply at the reality of our situation in a realistic way and recognize that because of the impermanent nature of the phenomenal world, everything will continually change, and the only wisdom we'll ever be able to experience on a deep level is what Alan Watts called the wisdom of insecurity. We'll somehow have to learn to live with the insecurity that's inherent in the existential givens that we're all living with, basically, right? One way of talking about this involves an understanding that one of the primary determinants of our level of happiness or suffering involves the way we relate to change. Does that make sense? Right? I remember years ago we had a monastic from Bhante Gunaratna's community in West Virginia come to our weekly meeting in Boulder. And he gave a really animated and excited Dharma talk that he was very pleased with. And at one point he interrupted himself and he said, I have to tell you people this wonderful news. I've come up with a mathematical formula for suffering. And Boulder, not unlike Cambridge, is a college town, right? It's got a major university there. And when you say something like that in a college town, people sit up and listen, generally speaking. And then he paused for some drama, and he said, S equals P times R. Suffering equals pain times resistance. Yeah. Now, in this case, he's using the word suffering and pain in a nuanced manner, of a particular kind that probably some of you are familiar with. When you hear teachers say, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. They're using pain to talk about the existential givens that I was just referring to, associated with the processes of change that are constantly going on. They're using suffering to refer to how we respond to that existential pain. If I respond one way, I get ground up in terms of that grinding stone image I used before. If I respond in a different way, in a wise way or a compassionate way, then my own suffering potentially becomes a gateway to compassion and deepens my ability to connect with other people who are suffering, turns me into a wounded healer, and puts me on the path of the bodhisattva. That's why, as undesirable as suffering and pain may be, what seems to be true is that from the standpoint of spiritual awakening, pain and suffering could be said to be functional. Can you hear that one? It's not fun at all. It's difficult. And yet it's true, right? I see it in my own life. I see it in the lives of people around me. I've seen it in the lives of people I've worked with for many years. When I was 13, for example, my father died suddenly of a heart attack. Right? I was at a Little League baseball game, summer night in August 1963, came home, note on the table, stay home, had to take Daddy to the hospital, never saw him again alive. Right? He wasn't sick as far as I knew. It was like a bolt of lightning. 20 years later, what was I doing for work? I was directing a hospice program. I was teaching people about grief. Right? Because what happened at that point was I had one sibling, my older brother, who left for college a week later after the services and such were over. And almost all of the people around me who were good-hearted, well-intended people said only one thing to me. They said, now you're the man of the family. So your job is to take care of your mother. Right? As if at 13, I wasn't grieving somehow. Nobody seemed to get that, particularly my uncles, because my dad was one of seven. He had four brothers and two sisters. Yeah. Right? Now, I certainly wouldn't have chosen that experience. I would have much rather my father were alive today to know my daughter and my wife. Right? But as you know, there's a lot that goes on in our lives that we have little or no control over. That's just a fact of life. As I said earlier, though, we do have a lot to say about how we respond in any situation. There's a certain empowerment that we realize that the teachings remind us of on a regular basis in regard to the fact that we can train ourselves to respond skillfully to the difficulties in our lives. When I met my wife, we were both living in Nepal in the 80s. She's a physical therapist by training. She was working with disabled children in a UNICEF program, bringing these kids in from far-out villages in Nepal for surgery and treatment and so forth in Kathmandu. Right? She was also a bit gutsy for me in terms of my style. I was so worried about getting food poisoning or some kind of food-related problem in Kathmandu. I read too many health-related books before I went. She wanted to go for motorcycle rides in the marketplace and sleep on glaciers at 17,000 feet. It was only after I got to know her that I found out she'd had polio as a child and had a brace on one leg for a number of years and couldn't play and couldn't run with the other kids. Right? Right? There's your wounded healer phenomenon. Right? It's not a surprise to me that she was a good physical therapist. So this is something that we want to be open to in terms of recognizing that although suffering is undesirable, resisting it doesn't seem to be a helpful strategy. Although in our culture, it seems to be a sort of something that's been raised to the state of ritual. If you look at the devices and the options we have for distracting ourselves from ourselves, right? We're living in a culture that's saturated with what a colleague of mine calls weapons of mass distraction, right? And I don't have any righteousness about any of that. I wrestle with the same challenges that I suspect we all do here in terms of difficulty focusing, feeling overstimulated, becoming too busy, things of that sort. And because of that, I think for a lot of us, it's really hard to remember what we care about most. Suzuki Roshi, some of you know of from San Francisco Zen Center, the founder and the late 60s and early 70s, put it quite succinctly when he was talking about spiritual awakening. He said, the most important thing is to remember the most important thing. And that's no small challenge in a culture like ours. The mourning that we do, the grieving that we do, when we talk about grief, joy, and awakening, is something I would suggest to you is not a problem in and of itself. It's a natural human process in relation to change and loss. Jack Engler, who used to teach at Harvard Medical School, I don't know if he's still there anymore, psychologist, did some of the earliest meditation research on Vipassana-related meditation practices. Jack put it this way. Mourning, letting go of the way things, of the way we want things to be, is much harder than coming to understand that we must let go. We seldom, if ever, just accept anything, especially anything that threatens our safety and security, what we feel we need to survive. Most of the time, when reality doesn't accord with the way, with our wish or the way we think things should be, we only come to accept it gradually, haltingly, sometimes with despair, almost always with resistance. Without grieving what we are being forced to give up, we don't let go. Grief work is precisely about coming to acceptance of a new state of affairs in which something we have cherished is absent. Through the work of mourning, insight becomes truth. Maladaptive clinging and desperate holding on are surrendered, and we start to live again. So that's a little bit of a shout out for grieving, right? Not that it isn't difficult, and not that there aren't tears and heartache, right? It's just that if we resist that or respond to it unskillfully, we add what the Buddha called the second arrow. We add an additional layer of adventitious suffering on top of the existential suffering that's unavoidable. Right? And there's so many losses that are just built into this life that we have that we can learn to be more gracious and graceful about accepting them, particularly when we understand that they're part of what moves us into the realm of becoming a wounded healer and stepping onto the bodhisattva path. I remember about 20 years ago, I was 52, so I'm 72 now. And I used to run a lot and participate in a lot of athletics when I was young. And one of my favorite things to do in my adult life, living in Boulder for many years now, was to get up early in the morning and run in the foothills when it was cool, before the heat came in the summer, and loved running in the mountains. The problem was I was starting to have a lot of pain in my knees. And I somewhat sensed what was going on, but I really didn't want to know. Right? So I put up with the pain for a while, talked to my wife about it, and she said, you got to get it worked up. And I went over to the Boulder Center for Sports Medicine. They took some x-rays and did a physical exam and so forth. And I remember the head of the sports medicine clinic came and put up these x-rays. It was perfectly obvious what was going on. The cartilage in my knees was worn down close to the bone, right, from years of various activity and not having a body that's in perfect alignment. So I so didn't want to hear what he was going to say in terms of giving up something I love to do. I became sort of just sort of stupid in a way. And I said to him, I said, so can you tell me in lay terms, what are we looking at here? As if I didn't know. Now, obviously, this was someone who had dealt with this kind of issue with 10,000 aging Boulder athletes. I could see it in his face. And he looked at me with this read my lips kind of look. And he said, well, let me put it this way. Cartilage is like tire tread. When it's gone, it's gone. And then he smiled and he said, I hope you like biking and swimming. Right? Because they're non-impact. Right? And of course, I said, oh no. There must be something we can do. Right? And I sort of went on that way for a bit. And he said, well, okay, we have one physical therapist who specializes in people like you. Basically, you know. And if you want to be set up with her, I can set you up. Right? So I spent an extra few hundred dollars meeting with this physical therapist until I got it and accepted a little bit more so that I needed to stop running. Right? And the grief was interesting. It was a good year and a half before I could not feel upset when someone ran by me on a hiking trail. I could hike, I could bike, I could swim, I could do most of the other things that I like to do, but that routine that had been so joyful for me was gone. I just needed to give it up. Confessions being what they are, for the first maybe 9 or 10 months, whenever someone came jogging by me on the trail, I had this terrible urge to trip them because I was so envious of what was happening. At least, fortunately, I didn't act it out, but I saw it come up. I was so disappointed, hurt, and envious. Yeah. All right. So there's a place for this kind of situation where the grief plays a role. It shows up in every aspect of our lives, oftentimes in relation to expectations. Years ago, when my wife and I were traveling back from Nepal to the States to move back to the U.S. in 1990, we went to Bodh Gaya, and among other places there, we went to the Thai temple, where a British teacher, some of you might be familiar with, named Christopher Titmus, who used to be a monk at that temple, teaches a 10-day course, back-to-back 10-day courses every January. So we did this course, which was really quite wonderful. And Christopher would say something at the end of the meditations he would lead that I'd never heard before. I was used to people saying similar things, you know, closing the meditation with, may all beings find peace. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free. Right? Christopher would say, may all beings be happy. May all beings be free from expectations. May all beings find peace. And I sat with that because I heard it on a regular basis for 10 days. And I saw the role of expectations in my life and how often I set myself up for disappointment when the situation didn't turn out the way I thought it would or should. Here's one example on this level. There was a powerful emperor who needed a new head samurai. So he sent out a declaration throughout the country that he was searching for one. A year passed, and only 3 people showed up: a Japanese samurai, a Chinese samurai, and a Jewish samurai. The emperor asked the Japanese samurai to come in and demonstrate why he should be head samurai. The Japanese samurai opened a matchbox and out popped a bumblebee. Whoosh went his sword, and the bumblebee dropped dead on the ground in 2 pieces. The emperor exclaimed, "That is impressive." The emperor then asked the Chinese samurai to come in and demonstrate his skills. The Chinese samurai also opened a matchbox, and out buzzed a fly. Whoosh, whoosh, went his sword, and the fly dropped dead on the ground in 4 small pieces. The emperor exclaimed, "That is really very impressive." The emperor then had the Jewish samurai demonstrate why he should be the head samurai. The Jewish samurai also opened a matchbox and out flew a gnat. His flashing sword went whoosh, 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 whoosh. But the gnat was still alive and flying around. The emperor, who was obviously disappointed, asked, "After all of that, why is the gnat not dead?" The Jewish samurai smiled. "Well," he replied, "circumcision is not meant to kill." Okay, so we've got we've got grief handled, huh? The bottom line on grief for me is being willing to turn toward it and look at it, right? Rather than avoid it, pretend it's not so, or desensitize ourselves to it, right? So much of what Buddhist training is about is seeing what is as it is. This is how Terry Tempest Williams put this one. "A good friend of mine said, 'You are married to sorrow.' And I looked at him and I said, 'I am not married to sorrow. I just choose not to look away.' And I think there is deep beauty," she writes, "in not averting our gaze. No matter how hard it is, no matter how heartbreaking it can be, it's about presence. It's about bearing witness. I used to think bearing witness was a passive act. I don't believe that anymore. I think that when we are present, when we bear witness, when we do not divert our gaze, something is revealed, the very marrow of life. We change. A transformation occurs. Our consciousness shifts." So, I'm not going to do that. Let's flip this over for a moment. Let me keep an eye on the clock here because I want to have some time for us to talk. Let's talk a little bit about joy and happiness, right? Because part of how we can understand what happens as we deepen our Dharma practice is our understanding of experiences and concepts like grief and joy change as we see through a different perceptual lens, right? Grief, when I was 21 and was beginning yoga and meditation training, was 100% bad news. I simply wanted none in my life if I could arrange it. I had yet to really see that I wasn't the problem, that it was inevitable, and that it could become a set of stepping stones to deepen my realization of what real happiness and well-being were about. Likewise, with happiness and joy, we live in a culture, and a lot of us were conditioned in such a way as to have some very simplistic and unrealistic ideas about happiness and joy. Specifically, for example, the emphasis in our culture, for the most part, is on what I would call conventional happiness. And what I mean by that is that it's the happiness of the sense pleasures. This is talked about in the suttas, actually. There's different kinds of happiness and well-being. One is the happiness of the sense pleasures. If we have delicious food, if we listen to beautiful music, if we have warm touch or a healing massage, if we have other kinds of sense impressions, they can be very pleasant. And we experience a certain kind of happiness and well-being. I'm 100% in favor of that. At the same time, as a lot of us have experienced, there's a limited stability to that kind of happiness. Right? If I'm at my favorite restaurant and eating my favorite food, and that particular piece of salmon has a bone in it, that happiness disappears pretty quickly. Right? So it's wonderful when it's there, but it's generally unstable and impermanent. The teachings also talk about a kind of happiness sometimes translated as the joy of concentration, which is somewhat deeper than that of the senses. It's sometimes associated with what in sports we call the zone, or what at the University of Chicago they studied as the state of flow, where we're so focused on a particular activity. Say we like to ski, and we're skiing moguls. There's a way in which we become one with the activity. We're so focused on it that we experience what's called mind-body synchronization, and we become one with the activity and the sense of being an ego bubble in a body trying to do something in a self-conscious manner dissipates and disappears, and we just have a sense of unity temporarily. Right? That's also wonderful. Right? Here again, though, not super trustworthy, right? If I hit one of those moguls at the wrong angle and go down, the joy of that flow state ends rather quickly. Right? There's a third kind of happiness that I first heard Joseph Goldstein talk about years ago in 1980 at Insight Meditation Society. And he called it Vipassana happiness, which I found, you know, kind of curious at first. I didn't quite get how that could work, right? Because if seeing things clearly meant seeing grief and difficulty, how could you be happy, right? But then he pointed out that there was a certain sense of well-being and happiness knowing that you were seeing things as they really are. And the reason for that has to do with the fact that when we're residing in awareness, right, it's the experience of being in awareness itself that is associated with well-being. So this begins to change the belief that we need something from the outside to go a certain way in order to be happy. So what I called conventional happiness a little bit ago means, you know, if I'm shortlisted for a job and I really want the job and I get it, I'm happy. And if I don't get it, I'm unhappy. If I'm waiting for the results of a biopsy and I'm hoping that I'm going to be told that something is benign and it turns out to be benign, I'm really, really happy. Right? But notice how dependent we are in that kind of happiness on external conditions. Right? The two other kinds of happiness and well-being that the teachings talk about, this Vipassana happiness, which is a lead-in to nibbana or nirvana, which, if you think about it, is sometimes translated as the unconditioned. Right? It's also translated as the deathless. But the relevant translation here is unconditioned, right? Meaning that we as human beings, according to the teachings, and none of us has to take this on faith, but according to these teachings, we have an innate capacity that we can actualize to experience a sense of well-being, wholeness, and completeness that is independent of external circumstances. Think about that. That is really radical. Right? And at the same time, if you look at the perennial wisdom teachings across contemplative traditions, whether in different schools of Buddhism or different contemplative schools altogether, you will see that same essential teaching showing up in its own specific language related to that particular school. Right. Here's one example from a book called Happiness by Matthieu Ricard, a wonderful Tibetan teacher, French-born, but Tibetan Buddhist who some of you might be familiar with. He describes this experience. There's a man I've known for 20 years who lives in Bumthang province at the heart of the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan. He was born without arms or legs, and he lives on the outskirts of a village in a little bamboo hut of just a few square yards. He never goes out, and he barely moves from the mattress on the floor. He came from Tibet 40 years ago, carried by fellow refugees, and has lived in this hut ever since. The mere fact that he is still alive is extraordinary in and of itself. But even more striking is the joy that radiates from him. Every time I see him, he's in the same serene, simple, gentle, and unaffected frame of mind. When we bring him small gifts of food, blankets, a portable radio, he says that there's no need to bring him anything. Quote, "What could I possibly need?" he laughs. There is usually somebody from the village to be found in his cabin, a child, an elder, a man or woman who has brought him some water, some gossip. Most of all, they say, they come because it does them good to spend a little time in his company. They ask his advice. When a problem arises in the village, they usually come to him to solve it. Admittedly, that's a very extreme example. At the same time, he's a member of the same species as every one of us. He's a human being. What really inspired me when I first came across Buddhist teachings was the fact that the Buddha was presented as a human being just like you and me. He wasn't a supernatural figure. He wasn't a disembodied figure. He was a human being just like me. His tears were wet. His blood was red. He had backaches like me. He got food poisoning like me at one time, right? And I could identify with that, right? So what we're talking about here is not that we shouldn't go through the ups and downs, the eight worldly winds associated with what goes on externally. Of course, we're going to feel happy when we get the job and unhappy when the biopsy turns out to be positive. That's part of our humanity. The question is here, how do we unify or integrate the human part of us, which is so vulnerable and so fragile and so time-limited and goes through so many ups and downs, with what the teachings call our Buddha nature, which is a dimension of our being that's described as a center of transcendent wisdom that's also an innate part of our human beingness. Right? Ram Dass called this loving awareness when he talked about it. Father Thomas Keating, who I studied with, talked about it in terms of what he called Christ consciousness. When I was teaching transpersonal psychology, we called it the true self, capital T, capital S. But one of the points of agreement, and this is where we start to move into what awakening is, right? One of the points of agreement among all of these great wisdom traditions seems to be that as human beings, we have an innate capacity to live on two levels of consciousness simultaneously. Right? We don't want to spiritually bypass our humanness, which is what some people mistakenly do with spiritual teachings. We want to be fully human on one level, and in the process of completely owning our humanity, our vulnerability and fragility, we actualize our innate capacity for self-transcendence. And we experience the deeper dimension of who and what we are, whether we call it Buddha nature or true self or whatever we call it. And then the process of awakening becomes a gradual process of infusing the way we live on the human level as a human being with the love and wisdom and compassion that's innate in our true nature, our Buddha nature. And we become an instrument of that true nature in the world. Right? That's my understanding of what we call awakening. So let me shorten this talk a little bit since I've got about 3.5 more hours. Let's look at what happens when we get a glimpse of that. And then the question, we can talk a bit about how we integrate it. This is an email that a fellow wrote me after a retreat at our retreat center outside of Boulder. We have a center called the Rocky Mountain Eco-Dharma Retreat Center, where we train people in engaged spirituality as well as contemplative meditation practices. He gave me permission to use this. Actually, I put it in a book that I wrote as well. He writes, "A glimpse. On silent retreat 2 weeks ago, during a period of walking meditation, a sudden fluttering appeared in front of my face. A hummingbird. I became so instantly still, not even my pupil shifted to focus on what was happening. After a moment, it flew up close into my beard and was poking around on my chin. Gentle yet firm, and with the same pressure each time. Then it pulled back, paused, and went right up my left nostril. It poked around up there 5 or 6 times, and again pulled back, and paused before going up my right nostril. Up until that moment, I'd had no thought. Total stillness. Now listen to this. Awareness was experiencing the process I call hummingbird as not separate from the totality, as awareness was also not separate. After a couple of pokes up the right nostril, a thought, will it move up to poke my eye? In this moment, the hummingbird moved back, took one last look, and flew away. I imagined that when I wondered if it was going to poke my eye, a thin layer of identity and separateness had been created, leaving me in awe." Right? So you can see the movement from duality to non-duality in his experience. There was a part of that experience in which there was no separate sense of Jim at all. There was just reality unfolding like a circle without a center. Yeah. There was no self-consciousness that was a subject experiencing an object. Right? Right. When we talk about awakening and enlightenment and the various terms we use for liberation, we're talking about some variation on that kind of experience that begins to become stabilized over time. Right? The scholar and writer Andrew Harvey put it this way. Here you can see grief, joy, and awakening. Enlightenment is to hold the entire experience, pain and joy, agony and happiness, in one non-dual eternal embrace, and to escape nowhere, because there's nowhere to escape to. Right? So the suggestion here is that there's a time for seeking and there's a time for finding. Right, and if I summarize what it is I'm trying to say here, I would say it this way. I'd say that when we work with these teachings, regardless of the school of Buddhism that we work with, if that's what we're working with, right, all of the various skillful means used in the diverse schools are essentially designed to serve a similar function. That is, to help us explore thoroughly and experience thoroughly the realities of our humanness, and in that process, to give us access to the realities of our true nature, of that transcendent wisdom that we all, according to the teachings, have a capacity to experience. The methods are essentially methods, and each of us will be drawn to different methods and practices and models and perspectives at different times. If, in fact, what they're helping us to do is to learn to live on those two levels and to suffuse the human level with the innate wisdom and compassion of our Buddha nature, then they're being used skillfully, and they can help us to integrate grief and joy and everything in between. So I'll close with some words of Jack Kornfield, because Jack's one of the people that's been extremely helpful to me in understanding what the teachings are saying and working with them in a way that seems very beneficial in my life. Whatever your difficulties, a devastated heart, financial loss, feeling assaulted by the conflicts around you, or a seemingly hopeless illness, you can always remember that you are free in every moment to set the compass of your heart to your highest intentions. In fact, the two things that you are always free to do, despite your circumstances, are to be present and to be willing to love. What I'd like to do is stop here. We're just coming up on 8:45, so we could do a very, very brief dedication of merit, if you like, to kind of bring the gathering to a close, huh? Yeah. Let's just take a moment, go back inside. You can have your eyes closed or open as you prefer. Take a nice deep breath into your heart center, at the center of your chest, as if you could breathe in and out through that area. Let's take a moment to see if we can contact a place of gratitude for the opportunity to come together this way in such a beautiful and supportive environment, with people of like heart and like mind, in the sense of sharing the aspiration to live awakened lives, to live with wisdom and compassion. And I'll close with an ancient Buddhist blessing called the Patanu Mudana. Just as water flowing in the streams and rivers fills the ocean, thus may all your moments of goodness touch and benefit all beings, those here now and those gone before. May all of your wishes be soon fulfilled, as completely as the moon on a full moon night, as successfully as from the wish-fulfilling gem. May all dangers be averted. May all disease leave you. May no obstacles come across your way. And may you enjoy happiness and long life. May those who are always respectful, honoring the way of the elders, prosper in the four blessings of old age, beauty, happiness, and strength. May it be so. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.